The first chapter of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad commences with the description of a symbolic meditation. The famous Ashwamedha sacrifice, renowned in the Vedas and the Brahmanas. The Ashwamedha sacrifice is a literal liturgical performance, a ritual of the Brahmana portion of the Vedas. But the Upanishad converts every activity external into an internal contemplation. So the Ashwamedha sacrifice is taken here as a symbol for cosmic meditation, comparing the whole universe to a horse, and the limbs of the bodily structure of the horse to the various structural patterns of the universe. How mentally you can perform the sacrifice and conceive sacrifice as ultimately a mental contemplation of the universal harmony of things, rather than lay too much emphasis on the external performance of it by means of physical objects and oblations, etc., in a visible manner. The Ashwamedha sacrifice, which is a visible performance from the point of view of the ritual of the Mimamsa, and the Veda and the Brahmana, is the object of meditation in the very beginning of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the concluding portion of the Shatapatha Brahmana, the most important of the Brahmanas belonging to the Yajurveda section. So, there is a very beautiful symbology provided to us for meditation on the whole universe as the sacrifice itself. A subject that is adumbrated in the Purusha Sukta of the Veda and certain other hymns of the Veda, where God's creation is regarded as a sacrifice on his part, a self-alienation of God himself as it were, by which he has become the other. This is the contemplation in the beginning of the Upanishad. The creative process contemplated as a great sacrifice on the part of God himself. So, as I mentioned earlier, the Upanishad has some resemblance to the Purusha Sukta and what follows from the Purusha Sukta and certain other Upanishads. The creative process is further elaborated in the following sections, which come after the description of the contemplative Ashwamedha sacrifice. How originally it appeared as if there was nothing. There was non-being as it were. This is a famous concept in philosophical parlance, that originally it was a non-being as it were. The word as it were is very important. It is not that something comes out of nothing. Nothing can come from nothing. That is a logical deduction, of course. It is not nothingness that was, it is an imperceptibility of things. The Nasadiya Sukta of the Veda is a famous precedent to this concept in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, even as the Ashwamedha sacrifice contemplation is connected with the Purusha Sukta of the Veda. Originally it was nothing as it were, in the sense of an imperceptibility of all things, because space, time and objectivity were all comprehended in the bosom of what you call the original waters, the cosmic waters, the symbology which is familiar to all religious and mystical doctrines. There was therefore nothing visible, because nobody was there to see things. The seer and the seen were clubbed together into a single mass of content which could not be described in any other way except that it was imperceptible. It was imperceptible not because it was really so, but because it was not an object of the perception of anyone. Neither was it an object of the perception of anyone, nor was there any chance of its being perceived by anyone on account of the absence of subjects and therefore absence of objects. This supreme imperceptibility was the Supreme Being himself, who revealed himself as this creation gradually in grosser and grosser forms. in various degrees of manifestation known to us these days in philosophy as Ishvara, Hiranyagarbha, Virat, etc. For instance, he became the supreme seer and the consumer of everything. To use the word of the Upanishad, Sarvasya Atta Bhavati. God became the eater of all things. The word eater here means the consumer, the perceiver, the experiencer and the being of everything. He was the subject of everything. There was no object before him. As he was the experiencer of all things in identity of himself with things, he could not be regarded as an individual subject and the objects could not stand outside him. Hence he was in a position to convert everything into an object of experience in the sense of identity of being. Therefore, the whole universe was regarded as food for himself, as it were. So, he is regarded as the supreme eater in the symbolic language. This is how the Upanishad began. Then, we are gradually taken to more subtle subjects and brought nearer to our own selves from the distant, remote, cosmic creative process. We come nearer to our own selves and to more intelligible forms of manifestation in the nature of prana, mind, senses, etc. It was necessary for the Upanishad to point out the distinction between the cosmic manifestations and the internal personal manifestations. The senses are internally operative, even as gods are externally operative. The gods are the superintending principles over the senses and the mind, etc. of the individuals. If the gods were not to perform their functions, the senses will not act. Just as if the electricity is not to flow from the powerhouse, the electric bulbs are not going to shine. And this is a very gross example for you. The cosmic forces are responsible for the operation and action of all individual principles, including the mind, the prana, senses, etc. But the individual is impotent, as it were, he has lost all contact with the cosmic forces. He has no consciousness of even the existence of these divinities. When we look at things with our eyes, we never for a moment imagine our connection with the sun, for instance. We are oblivious of the existence of these superintending principles. And we are intent merely upon the immediate action of the senses in respect of the visible objects. Why is it that the individual has become so weak, so impotent, so much deprived of cosmic energy, is the subject of the sections that followed afterwards. In the form of a story or an analogy, there was a war taking place, as it were, that took place between the Asuras and the gods, the demons and the celestials. There was a battle going on. And the Asuras wanted to overcome the Suras or the gods. The gods thought, we shall contemplate the Supreme Being in the form of Ukta or Omkara, meditate and derive energy and then overcome the Asuras. So they started this contemplation. How could they? They employed the various senses including the mind as means of contemplation. The eyes, the ears, the nose and various senses, sensations. And finally, the mind itself. When these meditations were attempted by the gods through these instruments of action, the senses and the mind, the Asuras came to know of this truth and attacked them. So, the symbology of the story is that you cannot contact reality either with the senses or the mind because the Asuras attack. The Asura means the urge for separation, the urge of externalization. The urge of the senses to come in contact with objects and the complete oblivion of the existence of divinities cosmically precedent to the internal manifestations in the body and prior to our existence itself. Gods could not attempt this contemplation. They were not successful because the Asuras attacked them from every side. But they succeeded when they employed not the senses or the ordinary mind for the purpose of this contemplation, but the internal prana which was in tune with the cosmic prana. which means to say you become successful only in so far as you are in harmony with the cosmic, and you are defeated in so far as you are away from it. When speech, as the Upanishad tells us in this connection, was rid of the asuric element in it, it ceased to be speech, it became Agni or fire, the deity itself. Likewise, every sense organ became the deity. The Pindanda jumped into the Brahmanda. The senses resumed their original condition of gods. As they were once upon a time in their pristine position which they occupied in the Virat. The senses, when they are placed in proper position in the Virat consciousness, are called the gods. They are themselves the gods. But when they are rid of connection with the Virat, they become ordinary senses. So the Upanishad tells us by way of this analogy that it is no use trying to contact reality through the senses or the mind. They have to be placed in the context of cosmic universality. That is the meditation to be practiced, which means to say the Virat is the object of meditation. Whenever you contemplate an object as located as a part of the body of the Virat, then immediately it assumes a divine character. It ceases to be mortal and it assumes a grand beauty which is characteristic of divinity. This is how we have to meditate really, and not merely look upon some object as if it is outside. Even spiritual meditations should not be attempted by mere sensory activity or mental function. That was the great truth told us by this analogy of the asuras and the suras battling with each other and attempting to overcome the other by means of meditation. Then we have perhaps the most central part of the Upanishad, which is the fourth section of the first chapter. It is called the Purushavidha Brahmana, a very grand and eloquent exposition of the supreme heights that our ancient masters reached in their meditations. By means of this Brahmana, known as the Purushavidha Brahmana, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad gives us a very complete description, not only of the nature of reality, but also of the process of creation up to the lowest limits of manifestation. This is not only a subject for meditation, but also for philosophical analysis and comparative study of various religious concepts. The Purushavidha Brahmana of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is a classical exposition of the famous Purusha Sukta of the Veda. The very beginning of this section proclaims that there was one being at the origin of things, and it is the cause for the primal will to create. So the will to create is the expression, as it were, of the universal being whose identity with this will is of an inscrutable nature. Neither can we say it is identical, nor can we say it is different. In order to explain the relationship between the creative process and the created individuals with the supreme cause, the doctrine of creation is enunciated in all the cosmological
hymns of the Veda as well as this section of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. The characteristic of this Supreme Being is said to be an eternal I, or as we usually say in common language, the consciousness, I am that I am what I am, or merely I am, or even the word am is redundant, just I. This was the primary status of being. In order to make us understand our connection as individuals with this universal I, the Upanishad explains how the one tended to become the many in the form of space, time and objects. This is the story of the fourth section of the first chapter of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the Purushavidha Brahmana. The one does not suddenly become the multitude. According to the Upanishad, the one becomes two. There is a split of feeling or experience, as it were, which alienates oneself into the subject and the object. It is a peculiar state of consciousness where oneself becomes the object of one's own self. The Absolute is neither the subject nor the object, because these appellations, namely subjectivity and objectivity, do not apply to a state where consciousness is not thus divided into two self-alienated aspects. So, what we call the state of Ishvara is the condition described in this passage at the very beginning of this Brahmana of the Upanishad. It is a universal tendency to objectivate. That is called Ishvara. The objectification has not yet taken place. There is a potentiality of manifestation, as there is a hidden presence of a vast banyan tree in a little seed of the tree. So was this universe contained in the little seed of the will of the Absolute. The seed which was the cosmic repository of every manifestation that was to take place subsequently. There was therefore the beginning of a cosmic subject-object consciousness, inseparable one from the other. Now this split becomes more and more accentuated as time passes, so that there is a greater and greater intensity and density of this feeling to isolate oneself from oneself into the object of one's own perception and experience. It is oneself experiencing oneself. The subject deliberately condescending to become an object of its own self for the purpose of a peculiar kind of experience, which the scriptures describe as Leela or a play of God. What else can be the explanation for that tendency in one's consciousness, where one begins to will the objectivity of one's own subjectivity? Apparently a logical contradiction, but the whole of creation is nothing but that. It is a logical contradiction. Logically it has no meaning and it cannot be deduced or induced, but yet it is there. The relationship between the individual and the Absolute, therefore, is not logically inferable from any kind of premise. It cannot be deduced from any kind of assumption, nor can we argue it from any kind of inductive process. But we have to take things as they are. The whole purpose of this story of creation, given out in this section of the Upanishad, is to help individuals to return to the Absolute. for the purpose of the practice of sadhana. It is not an explanation in the sense of a historical or chronological event that took place in earlier periods of time, but a practical suggestion given to individuals how they can reunite themselves with that from which they have been alienated, as it were. There is, therefore, a split of the one into two, and the two becomes a multitude with the same creative urge continuing in every part of the manifested individualities. That means to say, there is a tendency to go down and down into greater and greater forms of objectivity. From the causal condition, there is a descent into the subtle state, and from the subtle there is a descent further into the grosser condition, which we call the five elements, earth, water, fire, air and ether, and everything that is constituted of these five elements. Thus we have a cosmic integration with an implied multiplicity, or the other way around we can put it, there is a cosmic multiplicity with an implied integration or a unity hidden behind it. This is the universe in its apparent form. The Upanishad tells us that the manifestation was twofold, and then it was threefold, then it was multiple. It was twofold in the sense that the subject became the object and the whole universe was its own body, which it opposed to its own consciousness as that on which it contemplated, as I am I. Then the consciousness of threefold creation came into being, the threefold creation being called in the language of the Upanishads the Adibhautika, or the physical external universe, Adhyatmika, or the internal individual perceivers, and the Adidaivika, or the connecting link between these two. The transcendent spiritual presence which connects the subject of perception with the object of perception, that is the Adidaiva. There is a peculiar principle which operates between a seer and a seen object, on account of which this seeing becomes possible. But that transcendent element in the process of perception and external experience is always invisible to the external eye. So there is a threefold creation, the creation of the outer world, the physical universe we may say, the individual experiencers or jivas or souls, and the gods, the celestials, the divinities, who are the Adidaivas presiding over everything that is external or internal. So this is the threefold creation. Immediately the Upanishad asserts that none of these celestials is complete in itself. No part in creation can reflect the total absolute in itself. Yet the whole absolute is present in every part. This is again a quandary for us to contemplate. The entire completeness of the Supreme Being is present potentially in every atom of creation. And yet no atom, no part, no individual, no human being, no God, no celestial, nothing created ever can be a vehicle for the total reality. The finitude of any particular manifestation is a hindrance to the reflection of the total in it. To regard any finite object as complete in itself would be an ignorance. Here we have a corresponding enlightenment, a ray of light thrown upon this subject in the Bhagavad Gita itself in the 18th chapter, where we are told that it is the lowest kind of knowledge to consider any finite object as a total reality in itself. The whole of truth or reality is not contained in any object. But the ignorance of the individual is so profound that every perception mistakes a finite object for the total reality. That is why there is a connection established between a particular percipient and the corresponding object under stresses of emotion, for instance, where the object is taken for the total reality. Whenever one gets engrossed in any particular object or a group of objects, there is a mistaken notion of the apparent presence of the total in particulars, which is not true, says the Bhagavad Gita. To regard one's own family as everything, to regard one's own group as everything, to regard one's own community or even nation or even mankind as a whole as everything, is a finitude of perception. Because nothing that you regard as complete is really complete. The whole reality cannot be manifest in anything that is finite in space or time. This is to the credit of our wisdom, which always takes finitudes as infinitudes. The higher knowledge is that which recognizes an interconnectedness of finitudes among themselves. This again is a proclamation in the Bhagavad Gita itself. Where you consider one finite object as everything and you cling to it as if it is all, is the worst kind of knowledge. This happens on account of an obsession of consciousness in respect of a particular object due to the capacity of the object to evoke certain sentiments in the person at a given moment of time. But in higher moments of reflection, one begins to realize the interdependence of objects, that no finite object is complete in itself, that completeness is an interconnection of one thing with the another. So that there comes about the philosophy of collaboration, cooperation, and sociable and amicable relationship among beings. But this too is not the highest knowledge. It is not true that finite objects are complete in themselves. It is also not true that they are interconnected and therefore one is hanging on the other. It is only a tentative concession to our vision of the Supreme Being as reflected in space and time. But what it is when it is not reflected in space and time, that is the ultimate reality. It is neither interconnected, it has no internal variety, and it has no external relationships. This is emphasized further on in the passages of this Brahmana of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. All this creation is the manifestation of the One Supreme Eternal. Nevertheless, not one particular object can be taken as the all. Why? Because this Supreme Being is the I, or the center of consciousness known as selfhood in every particular object. It cannot be regarded as an object because the self is not an object. The term self or Atman in Sanskrit signifies a peculiar awareness in us which defies any kind of externalization. The I-ness in me or the selfhood in me is of such a nature that it cannot be set aside or set apart or isolated from my own self. I myself cannot become my own object. It is impossible for me to segregate myself into another other than what I really am for my own experience. But this is what actually one does in respect of other people and other objects, other things in creation. If everything is an I from its own point of view, it would be unbecoming on the part of any particular finite individual to regard other finite such centers as external objects of perception or mere tools for satisfaction of oneself. So each person regards every other person and each thing holds every other thing as an object of itself. This situation, where there is a universal objectivity alone and nothing of the self in anything, is called samsara or bondage, the world of thraldom. But everything is a self in itself from its own point of view. So if the point of view of the selfhood of every object could be contemplated in one's own mind, there would be an awareness suddenly awakened in oneself of the universal self and of things. So, at one moment of time, we can have two types of awareness as we like to have it. It can be an awareness of universal selfhood, or it can be an awareness suddenly of universal objectivity. We can be at once in hell, or we can be at once in heaven as we like. The consciousness of the selfhood or the Atman nature of everything is called liberation, which is true. Everything is a self in itself, but everything is an object also from another's point of view. So to have an emphasis made on this aspect of creation would be to find oneself in samsara or bondage. So one and the same thing is bondage as well as liberation. At one point you can see both heaven and hell. The earth and the heaven are both in one place cross-sectioned, so that the absolute and the relative are at one particular point of experience. This is a very great truth that is revealed to us in very precise passages of this section of the Upanishad. The Upanishad continues while it goes on, explaining this process of creation, telling us that all the principles of creation in various degrees of manifestation are the one reality itself. Whether it is in the form of gas as hydrogen or oxygen, or it solidifies itself into what we call water, or it becomes ice, it makes no difference. It is one and the same thing that appears in all these threefold manifestations. Likewise, the causal, the subtle and the gross appearances are nothing but appearances of Brahman in space and in time by means of causal connection. There was an awareness, says the Upanishad, at once generated in this stage of creation, where consciousness rose to its status and identified itself with all the multiplicity of creation and knew, I am I. This consciousness of I am I, in spite of the multiplicity of objects, is called Virat. This is Hiranyagarbha, this is Ishvara. This is what we call God or the creative principle. The Upanishad tells us by way of a caution that we cannot succeed in our endeavors in this world if we make a mistake in our attitude towards things. What should be our attitude towards anything in this world? The attitude that befits that particular thing. It should not be contrary to the essential nature of that object. If we put on an attitude towards any person or thing in this world which is not becoming of the essential nature of that object, you shall not succeed in your attempt in coming contact with it or utilizing it or achieving success of any kind in respect of it. What is the essential nature of any object or any person or anything for the matter of that? Again, to come to the same point, selfhood is the nature of things. What is selfhood? This again is a hard thing for the mind to grasp. The selfhood concept is a universal concept, in the sense that it cannot be manifold. The selves cannot be manifold. It can only be one. Because the selfhood of consciousness is asserted by every individual. There is none who has no selfhood in himself, herself or itself. So there can be only a totality of selves merging one with the other as rivers merge in the ocean. And as we have known many rivers in the ocean, there cannot be many selves in this consciousness. There is one mass of being, as we have in the ocean a mass of waters, where you do not know which river is where, and so on. Likewise, you can't recognize the distinction of oneself from another in this mass of awareness, which is the total being, the absolute. So the self can only be one. If that is the case, how can there be many selves? So that is an illusion in our way. We are not seeing things properly. When we consider any person or object for the matter of that as external to ourselves and put on a utilitarian attitude towards that external something, we are untrue to the nature of that particular thing, whatever that object is. Then the Upanishad says, Sarvam tam paradad yo netratmana sarvam veda. Everything shall flee away from you when you regard anything as non-self. There cannot be success in any walk of life where objects are regarded as non-selves, where you have a suspicious attitude towards things, which means to say, you dub an object as not what it really is, but as what it really is not. No object is an object in itself, it is a self by itself, from its own point of view. So to call it from your point of view as an object and to treat it as such would be to be untrue to the salt of its nature, and so it shall flee away from you. So all failures in life, whatever they be, are the outcome of an erroneous attitude of consciousness towards the external environment, is another truth that is made out in this Upanishad. I am going in a little detail in respect of this particular subject because it is the essence of the whole Upanishad. Then the Upanishad goes further into the description of the classification of society into what we call the varnas in Sanskrit language, which represent the grouping of characters in human society in accordance with their knowledge and capacity for the purpose of coming together in a harmonious mood for the purpose of the achievement of a single goal. The whole society, by which we do not mean merely human society, but the entire creation, is a manifestation in a multiple form intended for a higher purpose, namely self-realization. The intention of the universe is God consciousness or self-realization. This urge of the universe towards self-realization is what we call evolution. From every stage, there is an upward urge towards self-realization of itself in the universal. So whatever the stage of a particular manifested being be, whether it is human or subhuman or superhuman, from that particular stage, there is an urge to go upward, vertically as it were, towards a greater harmony and experience of integrality. So this is what we call scientifically today as evolution. This is what we also call aspiration. This is what we call the moral urge, and this is what we call desire in general. All these are therefore groups of individuals who have to work together from the point of view of their own species at least for the purpose of the ultimate good. The four varnas mentioned are the four capacities of individuals, the spiritual, the political or the administrative, the economic, and the working groups. These are really not connected one with the other, they are individuals of course. How can you bring about individuals into a harmony or a united formation? How can you ask many people to think singly? It is not possible. So, the Upanishad tells us, God created what is called dharma. The law of integration is called dharma. The law that binds multiplicity together in a harmony is called dharma. Any cohesive force is called dharma. Otherwise, there would be a split of parts into fragments which run away hither and thither without any connection among themselves. The parts of creation would apparently have no connection among themselves if dharma were not to be there. You know, there is always a tendency of things to meet together, come together and unite themselves in some form or the other for the purpose of a higher achievement. This tendency present physically or vitally or subtly or grossly or socially or intellectually or ethically or spiritually or whatever the way be, this tendency to unification is called dharma. Dharma simply means the law of righteousness of the absolute. And this law operates in every realm of creation, even to the lowest form of subatomic realm. There too you have got the cohesive force working, bringing particles together into a single formation called atoms, molecules, etc. In higher forms of life, it is organically visible as the living body. Then you have got the social group and so on and so forth. All which are indications of the fact that the Supreme Brahman or the Absolute is operating as an integrating law or dharma in and through all these manifested varieties which apparently are disconnected one from the other. So there is the creation of the groups of individuals and the law of dharma at the same time manifested to bring them together. So the whole of creation is very complete in itself. It is a perfect constitution which is laid down with all details right from the top to the bottom. Then there is a set of suggestions given by the Upanishad from the practical point of view. All activity in this world is ultimately futile if one condition is not fulfilled. You are not going to succeed in any attempt of yours in this world. You are going to be a miserable failure, whatever be your enterprise. You may be a very great philanthropist, you may be a social worker, you may have high ambitions in life to do great things and magnificent things. All these ambitions of yours will go to dust and you will go repenting, achieving nothing of a nature of a success in this world if you forget one essential point. What is that? That dharma or the law of unity, which is present as the selfhood of all things, the Atman nature in things, in the midst of all this apparent variety of activity. Every activity becomes divine in its nature, provided the element of the Atman is impregnated into it. Every activity becomes futile in its nature if the Atman is divested out of it. Every body is alive if the soul is present in it. Every body is a corpse if the soul is rid of it. Thus, the Upanishad very precisely tells us here again that we should not weep and cry if we do not succeed in life. It is our mistake. We have an unspiritual attitude towards things and this is the cause of our failures in life. We fail at home, we fail in our personal works, we fail in society, we fail even in other higher ambitions of ours which may be superphysical in nature. Where God is absent, nothing can be a success. Where God is present, everything shall be a success. This is, to put it very pithily, the essence of this practical suggestion given by the Upanishad. When you forget God, you shall be in the throes of misery at that very moment. And when you are in the presence of God, when you are able to practice the presence of God, when your consciousness is tuned to the consciousness of this universality, whatever you touch becomes gold. And any enterprise of yours is bound to be a success, whichever be the direction of yours. Success will be in your hands and failure will be unknown to you if Atman is your guide, if the Absolute is at the beck and call of your personal experience. Otherwise, you are not going to succeed. Everything shall be futile. There are three personal desires in an individual. Or we may say, there are three urges in the individual, which are three types of expression of the very same Absolute. The Upanishad tells us that we cannot be completely closing our eyes to the desires of the individual. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is a very complete scripture, as I mentioned to you. It touches every point of psychology and spiritual aspiration. What we call desires and called bondages in life are the blind movements of the same spiritual force. It is God Himself walking as it were, closing His eyes. That is called a desire. And you cannot call it undivine merely because it has closed its eyes. It becomes undivine only when it has lost the awareness of its purpose. The movements of the human nature in the form of desires called the Eshanas. These Eshanas are three types. We have studied in detail when we have gone through this section. These three Eshanas are the primal urges of human nature, are the blind movements of the very same cosmic force, attempting to unite itself with every blessed thing in creation, minus the selfhood in things. Its activity is of a painful nature. It does not lead to success ultimately. It throws the individual into sorrow finally, because its well-intentioned activities or movements are blindly directed. So, it is an unawakened urge of the universal, like the blind forces of nature, the law of gravitation, etc. They are also the absolute law working, but they are not conscious of themselves. So, the Upanishad tells us it is up to us to render them conscious, awaken them to the awareness of their own purpose. Then desires become directives of the soul on the path to the liberation of the soul. So this is in essence the doctrine of creation as well as the return of the soul to God or Brahman, as expounded in the fourth section of the first chapter of the Brahadaranyaka Upanishad. It is again continued in the further passages by way of the description of what the Upanishad calls the food of the soul. The Upanishad has told us that there are seven kinds of food which God has created for the satisfaction of individuals. The ordinary food that we eat every day is one kind of food. The milk that comes out from the breast of the mother is another kind of food, natural to children, whether they are human or otherwise. The sacrifices offered to the gods or the divinities called Darsha and Purnamasa, or in ordinary language we may put, the sacred offerings that we make to gods, especially during the full moon and the new moon occasions, are two kinds of food to the gods, which sustain the gods, because that is the way we establish a connection between ourselves and the celestial. There is then a threefold food which is psychological in nature, which is called in the Upanishadic language speech, mind and prana. These are the internal apparatus of the individual to come in contact with things outside, and therefore they are called the instruments of food. By means of this creation of the sevenfold food, the subject individual gets caught up in the object atmosphere. The objects catch hold of the subjects by attracting them towards themselves and making the subjects depend on them. Anything on which you depend is the food thereof, food of yours. And all these seven things are mentioned as things on which individuals or jivas depend for their sustenance. The internal or psychological foods, speech, mind and prana, are further described in their cosmical connotation, and we are told that we are supposed to spiritualize these external forms of manifestation called the foods of the jivas. And when we spiritualize them, they become universal in their nature. An object, when it has become universal, ceases to be an object. It is particularized and therefore it looks like an object. So the Upanishad proffers certain methods of meditation or upasana, according to which the seven kinds of food, especially the speech and the mind and the prana, get cosmically enlarged in their magnitude and they become part and parcel of Hiranyagarbha Prana. This is one of the meditations prescribed in the Upanishad. Anything can become a passage to God, provided it gets universalized in meditation. Then we have been told that individually no sense organ can be an instrument or a help in our contacting God. Neither the senses nor the mind can be an aid. But they become aids when they are universalized and they are united back to their original source, namely the deities presiding over the senses. If the senses and the mind act individually as if they are disconnected from their original sources, namely divinities, then they cannot succeed in their attempts. When they are connected back to their original divinities, they become cosmical in their nature. They become part and parcel of Virat. They gain their status in the cosmos instead of being located merely in the individual bodies. This is one kind of meditation where the individual limbs get transferred to their respective locations in the cosmic body of Virat. Name, form and action are what this world is. This world consists of nothing but name, form and activity. These, when they are externalized, particularized or finitized, become sources of bondage. Again the Upanishad goes to the technique of universalizing name, form and activity. Then it becomes the name, form and action of Hiranyagarbha Prana. This is one kind of meditation which we may say is the basis for the Karma Yoga doctrine, where every action is supposed to be divinity manifest and a means to liberation of the soul, provided names, forms and actions get universalized in one's meditation, which is supposed to be the background of one's activities in the world. As the Upanishad, the Bhagavad Gita will tell us that karma should be based on buddhi or jnana. So with this, the first chapter of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is concluded.